David Frost is the only person to have interviewed the last 7 presidents of the United States and the last 6 prime ministers of Great Britain. These days, he is the host of series for both the BBC and ITV, and of Frost Over the World, a weekly current affairs program for Al Jazeera English. He's written 17 books over the course of his career, including his latest, Frost Nixon, Behind the Scenes of the Nixon Interviews. It's actually co-authored with Bob Zelnick, and it's intended as a sequel to I Gave Them a Sword, a book about the Nixon interviews published in 1977. This new book is published by Harper Perennial, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Sir David Frost to my show today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a real delight to be here.
Now, because of the Gerald Ford pardon, Nixon never had to discuss his role in the Watergate scandal, and many people were surprised when, during your interviews with him, he actually admitted to wrongdoing and apologized.
Yes, that was a thrilling climax to the interviews, really. I mean, he went further in his mea culpa, really, than we had necessarily anticipated.
And maybe we should listen to a little clip of that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I must say, I sort of cracked up. Started to cry, pushed my chair back, and then I blurted it out. And I said, I'm sorry. I just hope I haven't let you down. Well, when I said, I just hope I haven't let you down, that said it all. I had. I let down my friends. I let down the country. I let down our system of government and the dreams of all those young people that ought to get into government but will think it's all too corrupt and the rest.
Now, that is astounding. That's an interviewer's dream that somebody will say something like that.
Yes.
Were you stunned?
I mean,
you were trying to trap him, but there's a big difference between that kind of statement.
As the second of the 2 days of discussing Watergate continued and he was going further and further, one started and pushing and pushing, and one started to think something like this was possible. And because on the first day of the Watergate taping, he had basically not admitted even mistakes, and on the second day he came prepared to admit mistakes, but not necessarily to go any further than that. And it was a question of pushing and pushing. And then when he finally said, when I said, won't you go further than mistakes, the word that's not enough for people to understand, and he said this heart-stopping thing of saying, what word would you express? You know, one knew that this was a moment when he was. Then one began to believe it was possible because he seemed to be more vulnerable than he'd ever been in his life before or would be again.
Well, I'm sure when he started, when he agreed to do the interviews, he thought, this is my chance to get back my reputation.
I think
it went in such a different direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. I think that he hoped that the tube, as he always used to refer to in conversation, it's the tube that matters, the tube.
If he were a British prime minister, he would have said the telly, wouldn't he?
Yes, yeah, the telly, exactly. Telly's never caught on in America, has it?
Sort of? No.
Never. But the tube has, anyway. And I mean, I think that he probably, when he started out, he was hoping that he would be in some way exonerated, in some way that it would work in his favour. And instead, he went much further with his mea culpa than even we had anticipated. And so I think that if you'd asked him a month or two after the interviews whether he was glad he did them, he would probably have said no, you know. But then 2 or 3 years later, he probably realized that they had, the fact that he had faced these issues in a forum that was clearly not in his favor in any way or in his control, enabled him to re-enter polite society to an extent, or whatever one calls it, in New York.
Because he had kind of cleared the air.
Yes, exactly. The worst clouds had been lifted, yes.
As we have insisted, if politicians would only say, you know, I made a mistake, and he actually did that. But he also was walking on thin ice when he and his team agreed that they wouldn't have access to questions in advance. Usually in this kind of a thing, this kind of touchy thing, don't people insist on that?
Yes, I've never given politician questions in advance. I think that's it. I mean, if you were interviewing a 98-year-old violinist, I mean, it wouldn't be so crucial. But with a politician, I think it is. And he didn't dispute that point very much. I think he realized for the credibility of the project, it had to be so. You know, I think that was what it was.
Do you think that he was more willing to do it because of your first meeting with him in 1968 while you were covering the election?
Well, I think that probably helped a bit. It was a very funny occasion because we got to his headquarters, new headquarters in Park Avenue, really ahead of the decorators. I mean, and we had sort of two of us on bare chairs in the Nixon's the One headquarters, as it were. And that went quite well, that conversation. It was more, you know, it was to do with the future rather than his past at that stage. And then there was a moment when I was asked, which as a Brit was an honour, but I was asked to do the Christmas entertainment at the White House in 1970. So that those were the two times that I'd met him.
Well, in the play version, Frost Nixon, he kind of dismisses you as a lightweight and thinks that he can handle you because he felt that you'd done puff piece interviews in 68. Was that your sense?
Pardon?
Was that your sense when you were dealing with him?
No,
that he
no.
did
I
that
mean,
he
that,
didn't that's... really respect you all that much?
Yeah,
or is that,
no, that
for the play?
That, I think that's a bit of... Peter Morgan's fiction. I mean, the thing is that I think Peter Morgan did a brilliant job with the play. I think it's a wonderful piece of theatre.
But many people will see that as real history.
Yes, yes, this book is there to show which was the real bits and which aren't. I mean, I suppose that, you know, Leonard, it was 15% probably fictional, the play, Peter and his producer had said that they thought it would be better if I didn't have editorial control, which I agreed, and the reason I thought so was that I thought people would then not think of it as an ego trip that I had brought about, and so on. But it does mean that there are bits of fiction in it that I would rather not have, but on the other hand, there's one bit of fiction there which I think is absolutely brilliant, the phone call, Nixon's phone call to me on the eve of Watergate. I think that's a brilliant piece of writing, and of course it never happened.
My guest is David Frost, who's written with the help of Bob Zelnick, Frost Nixon, Behind the Scenes of the Nixon Interviews, the basis for the Tony Award-winning Broadway play, and forthcoming film published by Harper Perennial. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. Well, it was interesting to look at the deal that you agreed to. First, you had to agree to the project. Then they had all the rights. You had to give up all editorial control. And when I was reading that, I wondered why you were willing to accept a deal like that, because I thought you were such a tough negotiator. But you say it's simply because you thought that the play might be worthwhile?
Well, the fact that these interviews have become a play in two capitals and a film and indeed a book, that is exciting in its way. I think when we were talking through the terms at the beginning, I don't think that I had any particular thought at that moment that it would hit Broadway at all. In fact, it was a London experiment. I thought at that point. I mean, as it turned out, a very successful one. But its scale took me by surprise. I mean, I was delighted, but it did take me by surprise.
I've always wondered who I'd want to play me in the films. I guess it would be George Clooney. Michael Sheen, I thought it was an incredible performance, but you were the one who was sitting there thinking, gee, that's not me.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, Leonard, about it is that I found the first time I saw it before, just before it opened, and then after it opened, and then towards the end of its run in the bigger theatre, the Guildford Theatre, and the opening on Broadway, and I mean The first 20 minutes of watching it the first time, it was an odd feeling. I mean, watching oneself up there on stage, it really is an odd feeling. But then quite soon, I began to think of this as not me, but as the Frost character, as it were. And I was particularly interested in how the material was being treated and so on and so forth, which I really cared about. So I mean, there was this funny moment when last December, when Michael Sheen was on my Al Jazeera show, and he was just talking about the fact that Broadway had been announced and the film had been announced, and he said, "Do you realise I'm going to be playing David Frost for the next year?" And I said, "Well, that's a coincidence. So am I." And here I am playing David Frost.
Well, it must have been a relief for him after Tony Blair. Well, what did you think of Frank Langella as Nixon? I have to tell you, when I saw the play, for the first 2 minutes, he doesn't look like Nixon. And then so quickly, for me anyway, he became Richard Nixon or became some incredible character that I forgot it all.
This was a stunning achievement. You're absolutely right. He looked nothing like Nixon. He's taller than Nixon and so on and so forth. And yet he gives a fantastic performance. And he said to me, talking about this was first of all talking about, and I gather from talking to Ron Howard, he did the same as this with the movie. But he said, "I'm not a method actor," he said. "You know, I don't take on a character all day and night for the period of a run. But this part is so tense to do that I do, whereas normally with a Broadway play, I got 10 minutes off, I'd go over to the stage manager and say, you know, didn't the Red Sox do well or whatever. But in this case," he said, this was in London, on the London stage, "that he would go to the back of the stage, the darkest corner of the stage, and where no one else was, and he'd stay there in silence. And then when the stage manager came to call him back on stage again, he would have to go over and say, 'Mr. President, you're required on stage.'"
He had to remind himself he was Richard Nixon.
And Ron Howard was saying that he did the same thing with the film for 2 months.
How accurate was the portrayal of Swifty Lazar, Nixon's agent? Did he make a lot of demands while you were negotiating to do the interviews?
No, Peter's hyped that a bit. He was very, very good, or whatever the right word is, very, very good about not fighting the editorial control point, which was crucial, obviously. Obviously failed, but the thing about trying to get it to be only 4 hours of taping, I don't think he ever said that. I mean, he would have realized it had to be 16 or 24 hours, you know, in order to make the thing right. And of course, and the other thing about Swifty was that he had a falling out with Nixon after we'd done the deal and before we did the interviews. And this was because he had said apparently in a cocktail party in L.A., he'd said, someone had said, "How dare you represent Richard Nixon?" And he had replied, "I'd represent Adolf Hitler if there was money in it." Well, now, this comparison did not appeal to Richard Nixon. And
I could imagine.
One would have to say, understandably so.
Go ahead.
So that they had a falling out. Now, and the good thing about that was that it meant that Swifty, who's loved to be the center of attention in a cocktail party and gossip about, that if he'd been coming to the interviews in the March when we interviewed them and got the mea culpa and so on, although they didn't air till May, you know, he might well have, you know, been tempted at a Kirk Douglas cocktail party or something, you know, to tell the story of how things were going so well for his clients, in my case, non-client. But the So that, and I said to him, years later, I said to him, "Why on earth did you say that dopey thing about I'd represent Adolf Hitler if there was money in it? You must have known that it would get back to Nixon and it wouldn't." And he said, well, no, I didn't say that. I said, I am not a literary censor. I would represent Mein Kampf if requested to do so. Now, I know which of the two versions sounds more likely, and the second one sounds like a rewrite of history 3 years later, you know, but
suddenly he becomes a constitutional lawyer instead of an agent who got Nixon $750,000, even though you only wanted to pay him $500,000, and some people felt you shouldn't have to pay him anything. He made that statement just after the check had been delivered, so he got his cut, and it was okay. It didn't really matter anymore.
Yes, no, $600,000 it was, yes, in the end, and of course it was very funny because the scene which really is this bit of it is really accurate. The scene of Nixon wanting to take the check as I handed it over, and Swifty saying, "Give it to me," but it's my check, says Nixon. No, give it to me. No, I'll bank it myself. That is not the normal procedure, you know. And in the end, he put out his imperious little hand and got the check. And Nixon was left like a small boy who's been caught with his hand in the cookie jar, really.
David Frost has written with the help of Bob Zelnick, Frost Nixon, Behind the Scenes of the Nixon Interviews, published by Harper Perennial. We will continue our conversation after this.
I could just hardly bring myself to tell Ehrlichman that he had to go because I knew he was going to resist it. I said, you know, John, when I went to bed last night, he said, I hoped, I almost prayed I wouldn't wake up this morning. Well, it's an emotional moment. I think there were tears in her eyes, both of us. He says, don't say that. We went back in. They agreed to leave. And so it was late, but I did it. I cut off one arm, then cut off the other arm. Now, I can be faulted. I recognize it. Maybe I defended them too long. Maybe I tried to help them too much.
Richard Nixon from the Frost Nixon Interviews. Frost Nixon is the title of David Frost's latest book written with Bob Zelnick called Frost Nixon, Behind the Scenes of the Nixon Interviews, published by Harper Perennial. And that he got rather emotional talking about Haldeman and Ehrlichman. The image most people have of Richard Nixon is kind of a cold, calculating, rather manipulative person. But there's a real vulnerable side to the man. And was that something that you sensed as you were talking with him?
Yes, I think the thing is that there were two, rather like Steppenwolf or whatever, that there were two Richard Nixons. One was the good Richard Nixon, who was emotional about his friends on occasions, who, at least in realpolitik, with the China and Russia, not all foreign policy.
Well, he did go to China and finally ended that silliness.
Yeah, exactly. So China was undoubtedly a coup and so on and so forth. But there was a blacker, darker side of Richard Nixon, which in the end you would have to say in terms of what happened, that darker side in fact won out in the end. But he remained at the end of when I wrote an epilogue to my last visit to him there, and I said, a sad man who so wanted to be great and so on. I mean, you know, you could feel that sense of him. At the time, of course, you didn't feel so sympathetic as you might now because there were still 30 people or whatever in jail because of having done what he asked them to do. And so you could feel empathetic more than sympathetic, but now you can feel the sort of the tragic side of it as well.
In fact, on the last of your last meeting with Nixon, you write, I look at Richard Nixon and I see the face of tragedy. He's an intelligent man in many ways, an incredibly able man. He thinks clearly. He speaks well. He's a man to whom history has relevance. He has a sophisticated understanding of world affairs, a nice touch for dealing with other leaders. He might have made a great or you said, I guess, a good Secretary of State, perhaps a great one. So yeah. that's where you think that his real talents lie.
That's absolutely right, and that obviously the combination of the event, there was obviously about Richard Nixon a sense of paranoia or whatever, and the events that took place were calculated to bring that out. I mean, I suppose one could say that it, in different circumstances that might not have come out in the clear way that it did in this case.
When you first sit down with him on March 23rd, 1977, what was your very first question? Do you remember?
I think it was, why didn't you burn the tapes, I think.
It was. What did he say? Because he had four reasons for not destroying them.
Yes, and the most ironic was that he thought that in fact it might make people think he was guilty if he destroyed the tapes. Well, of course, it was the tapes that indicated he was guilty originally. I mean, the old irony that always occurs to me that he set up the taping system to ensure his place in history, and it destroyed it.
Do you think that perhaps Richard Nixon didn't think he was guilty, that perhaps he saw this from a well-rationalized viewpoint that excused himself?
Well, I think he must have, when he talked in the way he did, as you were quoting earlier, in the last days or moments of the Watergate interrogation and so on, he convinced me then that he was a man who was saying what he meant, what he'd never said before, but what he meant, and so on. At the same time, I think there would be a sense in which he would always think of himself partially as a victim of the media, you know. And there's that thing in the book, for instance, that he says when we're talking. It's in the transcript at the back, but when he's talking about the what's gone on and so on, and after this absolutely exhausting 2.5 hours, that's the second of the 2 days and so on, we were both drained, and I said, well, it seems to me maybe what you said about the burden may be a little lighter after what you've said and so on. And he said, oh, no, you know. And basically he was really saying, no, they're going to crap on me, whatever I say, you know. They are. And he says that they'll go on doing this until the day I die, and I hope I can take it like a man. So, I mean, so he certainly had this feeling, I think, that the media were out to get him.
But then he goes on to take full responsibility, which is interesting.
Yeah. But
you, as I said earlier, have interviewed the last 7 presidents of the United States and the last 6 prime ministers of Great Britain. Haven't they all felt that the media were against them?
Well, I think that's a very, very interesting point. And I think the thing is that what is true, and it's not necessarily paranoia, but I think there's a lot of truth in what you say.
It's the role of the press to go after our leaders, isn't it?
In this sense, that I think that however much a leader says that he believes in the adversary system of government and that opposition should speak out and so on, that in fact, if you are the prime minister or you are the president and someone does a perfectly democratic but really tough condemnation of something you've done, there is something in most leaders that makes them feel that person is in some way unpatriotic. Do you know what I mean? They would never dare to say it if they were liberal or whatever, but if you've got someone thumping away at you, I think that, and you're the leader of the country, and certainly Nixon was like that, certainly too, but that you feel somewhat, they're just some way unpatriotic, and they're not helping. There are certain euphemisms people use about things. I remember someone was, I was going to Australia once to do some specials, and one of them was about the Aboriginal problem. And I happened to say to this, they say this to the then Agent General for New South Wales in London, and he, and I said I was doing this special and so on, Whitlam and da da da, and one special on the Aboriginal situation, and he said, "Oh, I don't think it would help anybody to do a program on the Aboriginal situation." Well, classic euphemism. Uh-huh. I don't think it would help anybody to do that. So, you know what I mean? But that's another one.
Because Australians feel so vulnerable about and so culpable for the way they've handled Aboriginal population. But many may have felt picked on by the media, but Richard Nixon is the one who made up an enemies list. You mentioned that there are transcripts at the back of the book, and these are complete transcripts. These are more than we saw on the television shows, aren't they?
Well, the in some cases there's a little more. The transcript of the Watergate program is the exact transcript that was broadcast.
How much editing did you do?
Pardon?
How much editing did you wind up doing on these shows?
Well, we did 28 and three-quarter hours.
So that's a lot of editing.
And we got four specials and then a fifth special by demand and a couple of other specials since of people wanting parts of it and so on and so on. So that I suppose that we're looking at 72 to 350, 500. I suppose we probably broadcast 10 hours out of 28 and three quarters.
In hindsight, and going over some of that material, do you think there's stuff that would be more relevant today that was edited out at the time?
Yes, so there are things that get suddenly become relevant. I mean, when Anna Chenault died, for instance, did she tip the word to the North Vietnamese that they would get better terms from Nixon and don't negotiate with Johnson? Did that happen or not? And all of those things. So there are examples like that of things that come as it were come back into and sometimes with the Middle East, people call up and we gave a set of the tapes to the Nixon Library as well, so that they were available there, too.
And then the way he thought about the Vietnam War seems relevant today in the light of the Iraq War. The Houston Plan it seems to be more relevant today when we are concerned about illegal eavesdropping, or government eavesdropping anyway.
Yes.
Because at that time, the Church Amendment had already been passed, and there was a feeling that that sort of thing would not happen again.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Those things do come back, and the Houston Plan. I mean, madness. I mean, the moment that J. Edgar Hoover emerges as a liberal opposing the Houston Plan. I mean, is a delicious moment, isn't it?
You've included transcripts from your sessions on Nixon's foreign policy in Chile, specifically your questions about the assassination of Allende and the usurpation of power by General Augusto Pinochet. Did he admit that he had a meeting with CIA Director Richard Helms on September 15th, 1970, authorizing him to take steps to topple Allende from power?
I think, as I recall, in that exchange, that he said that he said. He wanted Helms to do everything he could to stop Allende acceding to power. But, of course, no question of anything military, he said. But, of course, as I recall, Dick Helms, when he left the Oval Office, said something to the effect of, "I've never left the Oval Office feeling I had such a batons or such a weapon in my hand." So, I mean, it was obviously pretty tough stuff. Whether in fact Nixon actually did urge military action, I don't know. But he was pretty definite about saying he didn't go quite that far.
Do you think that Henry Kissinger will be pleased by this book?
Well, I don't know. He commented amusingly on the portrayal of himself by Nixon by saying, he said, "I suppose I suppose you've got the foreign policy program coming up next. I suppose I'm portrayed as a sort of unstable intellectual who needed the firm and steady hand of leader Nixon and so on, because I was unreliable or whatever. And I said, you know, Henry, have you been bugging the sessions? You know, because,
well,
I mean, of course, the interesting game that they both play in the interviews and in the book and so on is that they had to stay loyal to each other because they each had the goods on each other, obviously, in that sense. But they both did want to get the credit for the good stuff and try and somehow pass the bad stuff over to the other one, so that you had this funny situation of that with Nixon did take exactly the line that Henry mentioned there. He did take the line that, you know, that Henry, of course, he was brilliant and brilliant intellectual and so on. But like all intellectuals, he was, you know, could be unreliable and all that sort of thing. So he would get his point in that way without directly attacking Kissinger. And then Henry, in his case, took the line more of saying, oh, yes, Richard Nixon was a wonderful president because he was such a good delegator, and he delegated all the difficult things, of course, to me. You know, so that they were both going for the prize without alienating.
Now, we have very little time left, but I have to ask you about Al Jazeera English, which broadcasts your show Frost Over the World. In this country, only available through the Internet. Is it shown on British television?
Yes, it is. It's shown on Sky television, about 8 million homes, I think it is. And as you say here, I mean, that's one of their main things for the next year, is to sort out the coverage here, which has scarcely started. A few cable stations and
Well, many people Internet. In this country are quite hostile to the thought of an Al Jazeera network.
Yes. Well, what happens is that once you see the program, Al Jazeera English, the network, you see there's nothing to be frightened of. It's all in English. It's international. It's impartial. And so you only have to be in one of the 50 countries who see it to know that it's...
Well, David Frost will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store. His book, Frost Nixon, Behind the Scenes of the Nixon Interviews, is published by Harper Perennial. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, Thomas DeFrank. Gerald Ford spoke candidly with him in the years after he left office about everything from Watergate to his former assistant Dick Cheney. Then J. Craig Venter, who made headlines around the world when he published the first sequence and analysis of the human genome in 2001, plus the backstory behind the presidential run of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Angela Sheldon, Bridget Bergen, Rachel Krantz, and Stephanie Hughes. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.